WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When I picked up my mail yesterday, one big envelope said in big, bold print, "Terry Gross is one of our million-dollar winners." Of course, in smaller print, they made it clear that what they really mean is, if I enter the sweepstakes, and if I win, then I'll be a million-dollar winner. Well, why me? How do they get my name? And if I enter the sweepstakes, whose mailing list will I get on next? Well, my guest Eric Larson has the answer to many questions about how direct mail marketing companies get information on our lives. His new book is called The Naked Consumer: How Our Private Lives Become Public Commodities. Larson told me about the suspicious things he received in the mail that set off his investigation.
The first was actually when my first daughter turned one. Within 6 days of that, we got what amounted to as a corporate birthday card. And I thought this was kind of neat because I can't remember the birthdays sometimes of my own kids, I'm ashamed to say, let alone a million other kids. And here was a company that was sending us, to us parents, sending us a note acknowledging that we'd now had a daughter who had just turned one, how neat that was, and here are 50 offers that you might be interested in. So that was intriguing enough, but what really hooked me was when I had my second child. Within 2 weeks of that, I stepped out my door in San Francisco. We lived there at the time. And there, flapping in the breeze, literally, on my stoop, was a package of diapers, two Love's diapers, courtesy of Procter & Gamble. And what was so interesting about that is that, well, first of all, that they arrived, and second, that they had been delivered not by the regular mail, but by some other entity, presumably a newfangled kind of stork, I guess, but it was not the mailman. And then I was really hooked. And until that point, I had already started to see signs of intelligence in my mail, and I'd become really intrigued about how companies knew things like my mortgage balance, and that I had just bought a house, and that my car was about ready to trade in, you know, things like that. So I started looking, and I started trying to trace back my marketing persona through the databases of America.
So one of the things you did was kind of go undercover. What was your undercover hook?
Well, I had a couple of undercover hooks. One was I founded a direct mail company called EL Enterprises. And I did that because I wanted to hear what the marketers and brokers of names were telling each other about the rest of us. And that was really an eye-opener. I found a great reservoir of disdain for the consumer. You know, they refer to us as in many cases, as opportunity seekers, which is an industry euphemism for suckers. And they routinely trade our names and describe us as people who are you know, terrific targets and we'll go for anything, and we're really voracious consumers, and all that amounts again to being opportunity seekers. You know, you can even be on a database of people who got turned down for credit. That's a very exciting database for some companies because they can pitch you scam credit offers. For example, where you sign over your house in return for a credit card, that kind of thing.
So you founded your own phony direct mail company.
Right.
And then you also...
My favorite part was when I invented a new wife. There is one very large effort afoot right now to find out the names of all the pregnant women in America. I mean, this is of intense interest to companies because pregnant women will eventually become mothers, and mothers are, at least by the marketer's viewpoint, inherently neurotic and therefore susceptible to offers of all kinds, especially first-time mothers. So anyway, I wanted to tap into this, and I invented a new mother named Angela. And to insert her into this database, I called up American Baby Magazine in New York, and I said with, I hope, a proud tremor in my voice, I said, look, I'm about to be a father, and I'm very excited, and we want all the information we can, and I'd like to get your magazine, and how do we do that? And the operator said, well, what do you know? We have a special 6-month offer where you can get 6 months free. And I thought, well, that's great. I was delighted. And she said, now, tell me your wife's name, and I did. And she said, and now tell me when your baby is due. And I gave her the due date. And then she said, and is this a first-time baby? And I said, oh, yes. And then I waited, and the due date rolled around. Of course, Angela had her baby, fortunately with no hitches. The labor was remarkably quick, instantaneous, in fact. And suddenly, within 2 weeks of that, came this torrent of mail.
Well, I learned a new word reading your book. I learned several new words, but this new word describes why it is when you're daughter was born, you got little gifts from companies in the mail. The word is syncographics, and that's the word that describes how companies know how to sync up their product pitches with important moments of your life.
Right, right. That's the wave of the future. We're just seeing the beginnings of that now. And yes, I mean, this pitching all these offers to new mothers is a prime example of that. Probably my favorite example, though, was a writer friend of mine on his 40th birthday received a letter from a newsletter called Sex Over 40. It arrived on his birthday. And this is not exactly the kind of mail you want to get on your birthday. This letter essentially went on to describe all the sexual dysfunction that one can expect once you turn 40 and later on. So that's the kind of syncographics we might expect to see more of.
So how do they know when you're turning 40? This is because you bought some kind of product in which you told them in a questionnaire how old you were?
No, actually, there are many, many ways that they can find out your age. Probably the primary way is through acquisition of your motor vehicle records, which is very common. Some 35 states routinely sell your motor vehicle and your driver's license records and your registration records. And that, of course, includes birth date.
So in 35 states, if I owned a company, I could buy people's motor vehicle bureau records and use that to market my product?
Exactly, yeah. And it's done. And the states are very obliging about it, too. They will put this information on computer disks and I suppose CDs and sell it to you at cost. It's a marvelous racket.
Actually, you say the Census Bureau and private industry have worked out some nifty deals. What kind of arrangements have they worked out?
They have in the past. One thing I have to specify, and I always do, is that the Census Bureau does not give out specific names and addresses. That's very clear. They're very good about that. But what's happened is that over the years, Census Bureau information has been essentially co-opted by the marketing establishment. It seems now that really the Census Bureau exists to provide the marketers with information. And there have been some deals, some that were pioneering deals in all this direct mail industry, where companies were given first crack at information or Census Bureau technology well before the public even knew it existed. And in some cases, companies adopted the technology, and the Census Bureau found itself having to buy it back from these companies. It's kind of a curious arrangement.
Let's get back to your subscription to American Baby Magazine. You took that out under the name of your phony wife, Angela, a name you'd made up just so you could track what was coming in under that name.
Right.
And they were able to use this for, quote, syncographics, to have information to give other companies about the fact that you had a pregnant wife. There was a baby on the way. They'd know, you know, the baby's approximate age as the baby grew up, right?
Right.
What do they do with that information? They sell it to other companies?
Yeah, and sell it, trade it, rent it, you name it. The information migrates to various databases around the country. There are a lot of data exchange agreements in the works right now. For example, a lot of that information winds up in the Metromail database, Metromail being a gigantic database concern.
So if I'm being interviewed by a market research person, or if I fill out a questionnaire after I buy a product, it's not just for that manufacturer. They're going to perhaps sell that information to other people.
Yeah, depending on the arrangement. For example, if you buy a say a TV set and you check out, you find the warranty card, and you fill out the questionnaire that often accompanies that asks you about your personal passions and hobbies and income and so forth. you're not filling that out for warranty purposes. That's necessary to understand that right up front, although I suspect the companies want you to believe that. What happens is that information migrates to databases as well. It is actively collected and sold to other companies who want to get a richer sense of who you are.
You know, a piece of junk mail that most of us end up getting is the Publisher's Clearinghouse sweepstakes. That's the Ed McMahon You May Already Be a Winner mailing.
Right.
And you say that this is not just, you know, the way of getting business for Publisher's Clearinghouse, that it's an intelligence feeler. What is it designed to spot?
Well, now, we have to be a little careful about that one, because it is an intelligence feeler for Publisher's Clearinghouse. They assure me that they do not rent names to others.
I see.
But the point is that we encounter these intelligence feelers all the time. And the reason that is an intelligence feeler for Publishers Clearinghouse is that when you respond, you tell Publishers Clearinghouse something very important about you. You tell them that you're a responder, you know, which is, it may seem obvious, but it's very important for companies to know that. And depending on how far you go with the gimmicks and so forth, they get an even better sense of, you know, when I say the gimmicks, the various things you have to do with the envelope before you can send it back. I mean, they really put you through hoops now with all the stickers and all that stuff you gotta stick on there. They get a real indication of how enthusiastic you are about mail order stuff and about how far they can go with you. Other companies do the same kind of thing, say you'll get you may get an offer for a real sleazy product, say like a 35mm camera for $10.99. And if you order that product, first of all, you may or may not get the camera. You may get a real sleazy, cheap little camera. Most important is you have betrayed yourself to be, as I referred before, an opportunity seeker, a sucker. And they love these sucker lists.
So what are you likely to get if you end up on a sucker list?
Well, once you're on a sucker list, you're going to get a lot more offers like that. You're going to get a lot of offers for free vacations, you know, where you have to go to some condo timeshare resort. And once you get there, you realize that nothing in life is free, that you are subjected to a massive sales pitch while you're there. You may get offers, the oldest scam in the books, you know, waterfront property in Oklahoma. I mean, that kind of thing. Once you're on a sucker list, you can expect an awful lot of interesting stuff to arrive at your house.
Let's get back to your real baby, not the baby of the wife that you made up just
right.
to track just to track junk mail. When your baby was about to be 1 year old, she got a little gift in the mail. Now, how did they know that your baby was going to be one?
How did they know?
Yeah, what had you bought that gave that information?
I think where that came from, and it's the most common source of intelligence about who's pregnant and who's not,
mm-hmm.
where we betrayed that fact, and where a lot of women do so, and men, of course, is in the birth education classes that they attend at hospitals and elsewhere now. Often the instructors... always the instructors take down the names and addresses and due dates. But what is not terribly well known is that they also pass them along to other companies like Metro Mail and so forth.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eric Larson. He's the author of the new book, The Naked Consumer, How Our Private Lives Become Public Commodities. And we're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eric Larson, author of the new book, The Naked Consumer, How Our Private Lives Become Public Commodities. In many places now, when you're at the checkout line, you have one of those scanners. So instead of the cashier looking at the price, they just run the product over, I guess, a little laser beam or something. And
right.
it just automatically registers what the item is and what the price is. I didn't realize until I read your book that is also another intelligence network.
Yeah, that's evolving now as another hot new territory for this mass surveillance, as I like to refer to it. The important thing to remember is it's not the scanner itself that does it. I mean, the scanner is not looking up out of that little glass plate and identifying you. What happens is companies have now begun, grocery stores have now begun what are referred to as frequent shopper programs, where they lure you with special discounts and this whole sort of clubby thing to fill out a fairly detailed demographic application, in return for which you get a plastic identification card, perhaps with a barcode or a magnetic tape, very much like an ATM machine card. And so now, if you are a member, you step up to the checkout counter, and for the first time in the history of modern supermarkets, a truly unprecedented thing has occurred. They can at last link you specifically to your products, and not just that day, but throughout your purchasing history at that store. So you say, well, geez, you know, so what? I'm getting discounts, and they're getting information. The problem is products in grocery stores tell an awful lot about us now. Think about it. If you buy Preparation H, a company now can know that you have hemorrhoids and maybe run with that. You know, you can imagine the kinds of things that you might get, you know, scam cures and so forth. Let's say you buy, you're a prolific user of condoms and you buy them at the grocery store. Suddenly, a company somewhere has a real powerful sense of your sex life. And I'm not sure that people are aware that that kind of thing can happen.
So the more new technology we get, the more options there are for marketers to get information about us.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Now, one thing I have to stress is that, you know, there is a tendency to dwell on the paranoid aspects of all this, that this is, you know, Orwell and this is 1984. My true mission here is to have kind of even the playing field and just show people how companies collect this information. I mean, on one hand, it's a great technology story. It's also a terrific bit of commercial Americana. I've been fascinated for a long time with corporate excess, how companies get obsessed with collecting things and doing things. And this is one of those grand corporate obsessions to find out about American consumers. It's a terrific, terrific story on a lot of levels. And so I don't really want people to go out screaming to their grocery stores and say, my Lord, you know, I didn't know you were collecting this stuff and start burning down grocery stores. That's not the point. The key thing is to know what's going on, know how the information migrates, and then evaluate, is this a good thing or a bad thing? You can't evaluate until you know.
A lot of what you found is pretty amusing and just, you know, interesting to know about. Of everything that you learned, what strikes you as potentially dangerous?
Well, I would say that a lot of it is potentially dangerous. In fact, all of it is potentially dangerous. But you have to be careful when I say that. I mean that in America, we have in the past been at times in our nation's history very willing to sacrifice the civil rights of our peers. And often what is the most coveted commodity at those times is a list of names. For example, I cite after the invasion of Pearl Harbor, we were very quick to intern the Japanese on the West Coast. During the McCarthy era, lists, you know, people were brought before the Senate subcommittee to name names. That was the key, was naming names. And you think about some of those situations and you extrapolate to if those situations occurred now. You know, the technology exists, frankly, for a Senate subcommittee to go to one of the giant databases and say, look, we know that your typical card-carrying communist or Islamic fundamentalist or pick the group you want to target has these characteristics, shops at these stores, and has done this and this and this. Please print out a list for us of everybody who fits that profile. And then they can have a huge list that, while it may not be concrete and in and of itself totally accurate, could lead investigators to various people's doors without any real justification. Lists are just very, very powerful things to have, and nobody gave these companies the right to collect them, and we have no say over how they're policed, and that's always troubling.
So you see this almost as a commercial intelligence network.
Well, very much. It is a commercial intelligence network. And it's on a far vaster scale than I think anybody really appreciates. I think it's a far more effective and vaster intelligence network than anything the CIA or FBI came up with when they were spying on domestic protest groups.
Do you think there should be controls over it?
And now we get into, you know, a real tricky area. I think what we need is controls that help us Well, that help us, frankly, control the fate of our own information, and that help us keep certain bodies of information segregated from others. For example, there should be a Chinese wall between federal records and documents and about us and private databases. The trouble is, even that wall, which once existed, has begun to come down. Notably, in the way that the federal government will tap, has enlisted the aid of private credit bureaus now to track down, for example, deadbeat fathers and also anybody who has an outstanding personal debt to the federal government, which, you know, that was an unprecedented change which occurred in the early 80s without much attention, but it's a very significant one. It's, for the first time, a merger of those two bodies of information. So control of information is for the rest of us, is very important. How do we do that? I have some ideas. Mostly, I think what we need to do is we really need to have a real full-bodied debate to consider the technologies that exist today. And to say, and to paint some scenarios and say, well, how are we going to control this? How are we going to avoid this?
Now that you have all this information about marketing, do you wish you could use any of it to sell your book?
Well, interesting question. I had actually had this tantalizing thought, and I kind of suggested it tongue in cheek to my editor that we send to all the important book reviewers a special direct mailing telling them exactly how much they weighed and what their driver's records were and so forth. That didn't go over very well, but mostly I think because of the cost. it's a powerful kind of database out there to use. But you know, I would have been real concerned about using direct mail, frankly, to really alienate my audience.
Eric Larson, thank you very much, and happy shopping.
Oh, thank you, and Merry Christmas.
Have fun with your mail.
Thank you.
Eric Larson is the author of The Naked Consumer, How Our Private Lives Become Public Commodities. He's also a feature writer for The Wall Street Journal. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.